This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. In George Orwell's novel 1984, Big Brother deconstructs the English language into Newspeak, and each successive edition of the Newspeak dictionary has fewer words than the edition that came before. Big Brother is acutely aware of the power of words and language. Linguist Suzette Hayden Elgin is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with her about the powerful role language plays in our daily lives. We'll talk with her about multilingualism and the English-only movement in this country. Suzette Elgin is a specialist in applied psycholinguistics. She's the founder and director of the Ozark Center for Language Studies. Suzette Elgin is also the author of numerous books and audio programs, including The Language Imperative, The Power of Language to Enrich Your Life and Expand Your Mind. Listeners, your questions and comments are encouraged this afternoon. Join the discussion with the telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Suzette Elgin, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for asking me.
Would you tell us about your area of expertise within the field of linguistics? What is applied psycholinguistics?
Well, you know, linguistics is a theoretical discipline, basically. And applied linguistics is an attempt to take some of the things that researchers in theory find out and apply them to real problems in the real world. And an applied psycholinguist is interested in problems that have to do with memory and learning and perception, how we think, how we learn, that kind of thing, how we use language, of course.
When and how did you become interested in language and linguistics?
I don't remember ever not being fascinated by foreign languages, even when I was a little kid. And I was lucky enough to go to a school where we had to take Latin in seventh grade, which reinforced me. And then there were more languages in high school. It was before foreign languages became a frill. And so by the time I started college in early 1950s, I was set on being a linguist, and I've never deviated.
It's a fascinating field, and The Language Imperative is a fascinating book.
Thank you.
So many interesting things to learn here. I was very interested right at the outset to read in your book, there is no exact definition of language.
No. No, you know, and as you read popular accounts of language, you discover very quickly that people use different labels for different things. So you'll find a language called a dialect in one place and called a language somewhere else. And there's a famous saying in linguistics that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. We tend to decide that some manner of speaking qualifies as an actual language because the culture that speaks it is important in some way or celebrated in some way. And we'll look at two other ways of speaking that are almost exactly the same and speak of them as dialects of a single language. It is in many ways more a political decision than anything else.
Mm. You begin the book with a quote that cites the famous linguist Noam Chomsky.
Mm-hmm.
According to Chomsky, a Martian sent to Earth would conclude we speak a variety of dialects with mutually unintelligible vocabularies, but dialects nonetheless of a single earthish tongue.
Yes, that tends to surprise people because you think of languages other than your own as being just horrendously different, you know, exotic and unbelievably different. But when you look at all the body of human languages that we know anything at all about, you discover that all of them choose from just a small set of the same things over and over and over. Like there are only four kinds of grammatical operations in all human languages. No matter how many rules a language might have, they will always be deletion, insertion, substitution, and movement. There isn't anything else in any human language. So someone looking at the whole picture of what we might call Terran languages would say, oh my goodness, they're all practically just alike. And that does, I think, come as a shock, from particularly for Americans who tend to sort of have a language phobia.
Mm. Or language chauvinism.
One or the other, or both.
This earthish tongue turns up in our science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting to think about. This is why some Star Trek fans can learn to speak Klingon. I mean, there's actually tapes out there and dictionaries out there.
Yes, Klingon has been an extraordinary success. And it's a kind of freakish thing because there is such an aversion in Americans to learning foreign languages. By and large, we try our very hardest to get out of doing that when we're in school. And along comes this language that goes with Star Trek, and it's a huge commercial success, and there's an institute and a scholarly journal and a summer camp and translations of Shakespeare. It's most extraordinary phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I'm not at all sure that it's hard to understand, too, because in Star Trek they have this handy gadget called the Universal Translator so that they really don't have to learn Klingon. But I guess since we don't have one, you know, we do.
Yeah. This is a political question, but it involves language. Would we benefit if, in addition to our native, I know we can get into trouble by choosing the words that we choose, but if we had a language, a common language, in addition to our native tongue, would we be better off?
It's very difficult to know because we really have never had one. You know, it's one of those things that has never been tried, and so it's very difficult to know. From a logical and rational point of view, it seems like absolutely the only way to go, and you would assume every child on Earth from birth would learn, in addition to their native language, this universal language, this Terran or whatever it might turn out to be, Earthish. And that would simplify everything enormously for business and diplomacy and government. But there are an awful lot of hazards in that.
Hmm. What might some of the hazards be? Suzette Elgin, are you still there? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? I was afraid we lost you there for a second.
Well, you did for a second. Have we been having dead air all this time?
No, I don't believe we have. We've been talking together. We've been using language and going along quite well, but all of a sudden there was a click. And
there was a lot of crackling. There must be thunderstorms, you know, between you and me or something of that kind.
Well,
I don't
be.
Know where you lost me. I had just said that there are hazards to universal language. Shall I go on from there
and say
what they are?
My next question was, what are those hazards?
Well, there is the possibility that if we had an international language of that kind, all the other languages would die out. We are already seeing, for example, that the extraordinary use of English on the Internet and in science is beginning to mean a tremendous loss of languages all over the world. So there's that problem. And we don't know whether, if all the other languages were to die out and take their cultures with them, we would end up with anything useful. We know that in biology, if you end up with just one representative of a species, that's considered very dangerous. You know, you have no variety, nothing to broaden the gene pool there. So that's scary. And then there is, of course, the problem of whether we would suddenly find that everything was so homogeneous that life would become unspeakably boring. There's that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the fact of having to remember that the worst war of all is always the civil war. And if we were to lose everything but one language and culture, we might end up with civil war on a global scale. That's a horrifying thought.
It is. It is said when it comes to our health, we are what we eat. I wonder if we are the language or languages we speak.
There's a tremendous controversy about that in linguistics and related disciplines, with one side believing that languages really do have a very powerful effect on the way that human beings perceive their world and interact with it, And on the other side, you have people who feel that that's a lot of romantic hogwash, and that it is the languages who that reflect the perceptions instead of being the other way around. And up to now, we have not been able to find firm, reliable evidence to prove one way or the other, how that is.
Mm. What's your feeling about that?
I'm an orthodox Whorfian. This linguistic relativity hypothesis, as it's called, comes from a linguist named Whorf, and I really do believe with all my heart that languages structure human perceptions in extremely profound ways. That may be because of the inclusive language controversy, you know, the matter about whether we should or should not get rid of what is called sexist language. Obviously, if the social change has to come first and the language only reflects it, trying to change the language is just a silly waste of time. I believe the other way. I think that changing the language can bring about social change and facilitate it in some ways.
Mm, interesting. I want to talk with you about some examples
mm-hmm.
that you use in the book that you bring to the reader's attention about how language affects our perceptions of the world. The first one that I want to draw your attention to is that of linguist Dan Moonhawk Alford.
Oh, yes.
He offers the example, I'm going to read from your book, the example of a Cheyenne parent who is sitting with a child on his knee when a ball suddenly bounces across the floor. An English-speaking parent would say to the child, "Look, ball." The Cheyenne parent, Alford tells us, would say, "Look, bouncing."
Uh-huh.
Both parents are perceiving the same stimulus with the same sensory equipment. However, the way they express this perception, which tells the child what is important to pay attention to, is not the same.
That's right. And that, I think, is a very important point. The fact, it's not so much that perhaps you wouldn't be saying, well, this locks the child into a particular way of talking or understanding, but that it is a way of saying to the child, this is the part of what you are perceiving that is really important, that matters, and that you should give your attention to. And in English, we tend to focus on the nouniness of things in many ways, where other languages might focus on the verbiness. I'm oversimplifying horrendously, but that is basically the split that you're seeing there. So then the language that I worked with as a graduate student, Navajo, for example, has example after example of that kind. In Navajo, to say there is a road around the lake, you have to say something that in English would translate as it is roading around the lake, because there isn't an object road, but there is this roading process that is going on. And you have to be very careful that you don't fall into a lot of romantic warbling when you talk about that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's another example of the Navajo language and in the book, the difference between how we speak in English about riding a horse mm-hmm. and how a Navajo speaker would mm-hmm. speak about being with a horse.
Yeah, it's even more than that. It comes out in the scenario that I gave to all my Navajo consultants. What I got back translates in English essentially, the horse was animaling about with me.
Mm-hmm.
And the animaling about being a kind of motion verb that's only appropriate, you know, for animals. And there's a big difference between the situation in English where you say, me master, you horse, you know, I'm doing something to you, horse, I'm riding you. And the situation in Navajo where it is the horse and I are going around doing this together like dancing with someone. And it does provide a different way of considering the situation. You don't want to leap to the conclusion, however, that this is the famous Native American worldview, because the Hopi mm-hmm. do it quite differently. You know, they do with a horse, but it's like with a spoon or with a spade. It's the horse is what the Hopi uses to go about with.
Mm.
So in the different languages, you find this one very simple act and relationship being expressed in a very different way. And to me, it's almost impossible to imagine that over the course of a lifetime, this would not affect the way you perceived horses. Mm-hmm. Whether they were like a spoon that you eat with, or they were like a ball that you kicked, or they were like a partner that you danced with. It seems to me that those are very different things, and that it is the language that is determining them.
Yeah. Well, now because we've talked about Native American languages, a couple of them, just two of them, I want to let's bring in another example that I found was really fascinating. And the political implications of this are really jump out at me. The example of Native English speakers who are healthcare workers in India working with people who are taking their water from the Ganges.
Yes, yes. That was a very striking thing, because when the health workers first began trying to deal with this situation, the Ganges, you're putting your corpses in it, you're bathing in it, you're washing clothes in it, you're taking drinking water from it. It's obviously a very serious problem in health. And the Indians, by and large, spoke English. It's a very widespread language in India. But when you tried to talk to them about pollution and about the river Ganges being polluted, there was a very serious problem, because the Ganges is holy. And it was only when the health workers began to reframe that situation in terms of taking care of the river as opposed to unpolluting it, that they began to have response from the people they were working with, and it made an extraordinary difference.
Mm. It is like, we're not taking care of our mother.
Exactly.
Correctly.
As opposed to, here's this dirty liquid. You know, the river was not a dirty liquid to the Indians. It was a holy thing, like their mother.
Yeah.
And you couldn't say it's polluted. That was simply impossible.
You know, and here in English, in American English, we talk about pollution all
yes.
the time. And we it's very technical. And we use words like non-point pollution. And it separates us, I guess, from the environment,
doesn't it? It's called distancing. Mm. There's a place in the book where I talk about a woman, Carol Cohn, who worked as in an atomic and nuclear studies program, and found that as long as she used the vocabulary of nuclear speak, it's got all the surgical strikes and collateral damage and so on, she could not hold in her mind the horror of what was actually happening to real people. And that is an important point. Even though she was someone who was very seriously opposed to nuclear war, when she went into the program, she found that she could not hold those feelings of opposition if she was talking in the vocabulary that was used in the program. Mm. And that tells you something.
Mm-hmm. Suzette Hayden Elgin is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her book, The Language Imperative, The Power of Language to Enrich Your Life and Expand Your Mind. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. If you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, join us at this number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I read an interview, it's been a little while ago now, with an Irish writer by the name of John Banville in a newspaper. And he said that even though the Irish language has all but disappeared, the English spoken in Ireland has elements of the old language, Irish.
Uh-huh.
What do you think?
You know, if that is really true, it's wonderful. We would like very much to think that even though a particular group of people might lose the language that had been native to them, they could preserve their culture, and that their culture would shape the language that they began to speak. That would be wonderful if we knew that would be true. I'm not so sure in Ireland, because the Irish language has been making quite a vigorous comeback.
Well, that's interesting. How difficult is it, though, to pull back a language that has been so trampled?
It is so difficult. the linguists all over the world, by and large, are working constantly in an effort to save languages, and we're constantly putting our foot in it, you know, because you're dealing with different cultures and different perceptions of language and how languages should be dealt with. And with the best will in the world, it is incredibly difficult to save a language, because the only way a language can really be saved is by the children. You have to have children being born who learn the language as native speakers and go on to use it. That's, otherwise, it dies each time an adult dies. You know, it's gone. And if it's extremely difficult to speak it in the home with one's children, or if it's looked down upon, or if it's felt that for the child to grow up speaking a particular language is going to hold them back in the world, then the parents aren't willing to do it, and the children grow up without it, and the language dies. And we have a lot of programs now going on, but they are incredibly labor-intensive. There's a scholar, Leanne Hinton, who is in the forefront of this work, and she has to live her entire life with the native speaker of a language, day in and day out. And it's an extremely difficult task to make people feel that it is worth all that work.
We got some listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with a caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I'd like to take umbrage with a couple of points you brought up in a friendly and scholarly way, I hope. I'm a recent graduate from the U of I and have studied not only as part of that foreign languages, but also information sciences. And I wanted to point out that with regard to the question of a universal language or universal tongue, if you were to look to the examples in Europe, where, as an example, in Germany, everyone is taught Hochdeutsch, High German, and yet if you go into the countryside or anywhere in Germany, you will find very profound, strong dialects of German, which are, in many cases, vastly different from the High German, and it doesn't seem to cause a problem there. And, you know, the standardized language is the language of the court and documents and things like that, but the vernacular of the street and of family life and so forth can be very, very much different, and it doesn't seem to cause any trouble. Another is that with this entire question of gender neutralizing the English language, I would like to point out that virtually all other languages on the planet have grammatic gender, which emphasizes differences like that in some cases, or in other cases causes certain genders to just disappear in certain settings. And that, too, doesn't seem to have caused any problem. Again, in the case of Germany, the legally speaking, women in Germany have a far, far, far better legal footing than they do in this country, and yet, it doesn't seem to have caused a problem. And the third, just for your information, is something we looked at in the information sciences courses I took here. Yes, for a time, the Internet was causing English to be the standard language, which I think was probably, if I remember right, was due to the fact that the ASCII character set was the limiting factor. But now, with advances in computer technology and code writing and so forth, many, many languages have their unique character sets available for not only posting on the web, but also for email communication and so on and so forth. And if anything, it has caused a reversal of that effect in that there is a tendency now for people to very proudly put their small, distinctive language on the Internet and try to protect it in that fashion.
Thank you.
I fired my bolts, and I'll get off and let you respond.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's start with the idea of High German and sort of the idea of a formal language and then less formal language.
Yeah. I certainly don't want to in any way give the impression that the gentleman is in error, but I think the problem is one of scope here, because the issue you and I were talking about was the whole globe. And he's talking about Germany, which is a very small country. Certainly, within a small country, you can have several dialects of a language, especially a language like German, which has a very long written history, has a very large literature, has political clout, and so on, without the standard form of the language doing any damage to the less favored ones. I don't think you can extrapolate from that to the entire world of human languages of all different families coming from different cultures and nations. So I think, although what he had to say was very interesting, I don't think it's particularly relevant.
Gender in language.
Gender in language. There is a difference, of course, between grammatical gender, which he was talking about, as in French, where the table is feminine and the bed is masculine. In German, you have neuters as well, and so on. And he is saying that that doesn't seem to have caused any problem. It causes, if you look at biological gender, which is male, female, and other, you find that when you, particularly in an area such as religion, for example, tremendous problems are caused by the fact that the grammar forces the choice of masculine forms everywhere, and that makes all women be obliged to worship only in a context of masculinity. And as you go from one culture to another, the areas of the culture where that's going to be a problem change, of course, and differ. But religion is one that that comes immediately to mind and is easy to follow. I don't think you can say that because grammatical gender hasn't harmed those languages that have it, which are, by the way, primarily the Indo-European languages, we can say that that inclusive language is a silly frill. But there are a lot of people who would agree with him.
Mm. And the last thing that he mentioned was the Internet, and that it is a place where you can find many different languages now.
Yeah, but the problem is the quality of those other languages, okay? It is certainly true that we no longer have the situation in which English is more than 90% of all language on the Internet. That's not true. Now you can find translations, you can find material in character sets of Japanese and Chinese, you can find all those sorts of things, but English continues to be overwhelmingly the language in which communication takes place if it's going to be multilingual communication at all. So if you have seven scientists from all over the world all speaking different languages and they want to discuss something together on a listserv, for example, it is almost always going to be English that they have to discuss it in because that will be the language they have in common. It won't be Japanese and it won't be German and it won't be Esperanto.
Let's talk with another listener on line four on campus. Good afternoon.
Yeah. Oddly enough, I was going to say something about Esperanto to start with, which you just left off with. But in the local, in the Chicago Sun-Times today, they have an article about the only film that was ever made in Esperanto, and it has William Shatner in it.
Yeah. And, by coincidence. Yes.
Yeah. And I guess they're releasing it in video or whatever, but mm-hmm. I think that was kind of funny. But the I wanted to ask you, you said there were four operations, addition,
yes,
deletion, substitution, and what?
And movement.
Oh, movement.
Moving things around, like going from I hate science fiction to science fiction I hate, you know, where you move pieces. And if you can think of a fifth one, I'd be thrilled, and so would all linguists. You know, and no one has ever been able to find a language that had any grammatical operation that could not be reduced to one of those four processes.
Well, I'm just, why I call is because I wanted to know if I recall taking a course a long time ago having to do with computer operations, and they also had a very small set of operations,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering if there's a one-to-one correlation on that, because, you know, the computers use languages, of course,
yes,
as well.
I think there would have to be, because what we talk about, of course, is computer languages. And that's what we use to program computers and to do software and so on. Since it's human beings doing it, they're very unlikely to be able to think of any operation a computer language can do that isn't using one of those processes. It's going to come out to be the same, even if perhaps in some totally hypothetical world it might not be necessary.
Okay, so to the best of your knowledge, programs don't use any more than four operations either.
To the best of my knowledge, I have to warn you, I'm not a specialist in computer languages, but I'd be very surprised if that's not true.
Yeah, well, I'm not, I don't recall, actually, but I'll have to look it up. But the other thing is, and then I'll hang up and ask you, I'll let you answer over the radio.
Okay.
Is I was curious as whether or not these operations if there's some way to say that the operations needed to perform logical deductions and inductions, analysis, are these four sufficient to do that? And if so, if not, how do you find a discrepancy? And I'll let you answer. Thanks.
Okay. This is a question that requires a monograph in response, but I'm going to do something other than a monograph. If it is not the case that the four operations that we have, substitution, deletion, insertion, and movement, are adequate to express everything that we logically need to express, we're in big trouble because we have absolutely no way to get at any other operation. The whole idea of those four operations appears to be part of the way the human brain is put together, and someone who could come up with additional operations is probably an extraterrestrial, not Terran. My students would always say, but what could the other kinds of operations be like? I can't think of any. And I say, that's the point. You know, you are a human being, and that's all you can think of. And if you look at a written grammar book of the traditional kind, and you see that it contains, maybe 736 grammar rules, you know, you think, good heavens, we have 6,000 to 10,000 languages, and each of them has 700 to 1,000 grammar rules. That's millions of... But when you look at all of them together and discover that they are all only four kinds of rule, it reminds you that we are all one species.
Is our ability for language hardwired?
You know, I'm going to sound like Clinton and say it depends on how you define hardwired, but it really does. There doesn't appear to be any question at all that human beings are born with some sort of specifications of language as part of their biological equipment. Some way that they are predisposed to understand certain things as being part of a language and certain things as not being a part of it. You don't have little children suddenly leaping to the conclusion that when a garbage can lid is dropped, that must be part of a language and trying to figure out what it means. There is something in the human brain at birth that predisposes us toward human languages. Whether that is extremely elaborate so that all of the operations are there with their specifications or just a sort of a very rough guide that points you in the right direction is a matter of much dispute. And you have very powerful and important scholars on both sides of that issue. We do know that the human being is not born as a blank slate where languages are concerned.
And while... Now, correct me if I'm using the language incorrectly here, but if we have an innateness for language, it still has to be engaged or encouraged, doesn't
it? Yes, it does. If you isolate a child entirely from language input from birth, that child gets past puberty without any normal language input. They will never learn to speak a language normally, even with the best of instruction. And that is fortunately an extremely rare kind of happening. There is something innate there, and the period of your greatest power in language learning is before puberty. And of course we respond to that in this country by starting language instruction usually at the college level.
Yeah, or in high school if you're lucky.
If you're very, very lucky. That makes no sense at all unless it is a deliberate strategy to try to maintain the culture. Then I suppose it would make some sense.
What are linguists learning about language in the brain as the result of brain imaging technologies we have now, like the CT and the MRI?
It's wonderful because you can find out about alive people. You know, there was a time when the only way you could get a look at a human brain was for the person to have died first, you know, or to be in terrible disarray, needing brain surgery or something of that kind. And the number of brains that one could work with was just minuscule, and it was so rare. Now, with the new imaging techniques, particularly the much less invasive ones that we have now, it's beginning to be possible to really get a look at what is going on inside the brain when people use language. The problem is that the whole field is so new that even though you can see what's happening, you don't necessarily know what it means. You know, the fact that a particular part of the brain lights up when someone speaks poetry or something, mm-hmm. you know, you have no way of knowing whether there is a direct cause-effect link there or not. It may be a coincidence. And so we are just beginning to explore these things and to try to find out what really is going on.
Really interesting.
Oh, it's fascinating, yes.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener on line one in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Apropos that subject, maybe this hasn't been done yet, but there's this idea of the split brain business, mm-hmm. Barry Gonzaga and the...
Yes.
The object and the context kind of argument, and there's also the gender-related...
The
theory that that women are more integrated and don't split it as much, and
yes. Or they are more emotional and less rational, and you can pick your set of studies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like for you to expand on that, and I'll listen off the air.
Okay. The split brain research, I think, was perhaps not his where he really wanted to go with this. He was more interested in what has come out of that. There is a lot of research being reported lately that makes claims about gender differences in the sense of biological gender showing up from research with human brains and with human languages. I think that we have to be extremely careful about all of that research. For one thing, we have no way at all of knowing whether a particular effect in a human brain was there when the child was born, biologically male or female, or is the result of 20, 30 years of using language and functioning in a culture in the way that is considered appropriate for a particular biological gender. There's no way to separate out what was inherent in the brain at birth and what is the result of living as a woman or as a man or as a transgendered person for a lifetime. We can't tell. For another thing, all of that research right now is based on extremely small studies. And there's a famous anecdote about a man who was studying the brains of murderers and had made what he thought was a fabulous discovery and was just ready to write the paper. And just to be absolutely safe, he checked his own brain and found the same thing. You know, there's always the possibility with a small number of brains that if you looked at one more, you'd find radically different things. I think we have to hold off on that kind of research for a while.
Let's talk with another listener on line two in Champaign. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. This is a wonderful program. I have a comment and a question. I've been studying intermittently Irish Gaelic for many years because I love the sound of it.
Good for you.
And I've had some other language experience. I was fortunate enough to get French in sixth grade, and I'm 52, so that was a while ago. I think it is critical to learn language while you're younger. I wonder if, as you began to speak about earlier, the recurrence of people studying Gaelic, not only in the Gaeltacht in West Ireland, but other dialects, is a function of their reclaiming their Irishness as a nation, and that could be also done with other countries, other languages. My question is, neurolinguistically, neurologically, through PET scanning or otherwise, is there a way you can account for or describe what is commonly known as someone having an ear for language, someone for whom reproducing linguistic sounds comes easier than other people? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, great questions.
It's a great question, yes. So far as we can determine, there's nothing yet in neurolinguistics that explains to us that faculty of an ear for language, any more than there is something from neurolinguistics that would explain to us musical talent or artistic talent. we don't know precisely what combination of factors in the brain lead some people to be very quick and skilled at picking up other kinds of languages and other people to have to struggle endlessly. I wish we did know. And particularly, I wish we did know if we could also fix it. But we don't.
And the previous question about Irish...
Irishness. That is all part of this huge controversy over whether it is possible to have a culture without its language, you know, because there is a logical case to be made for the idea, say your language is Kwakiutl, you know, a Native American language spoken by a small number of people, all right, and you would say, well, that language isn't really useful for the young people coming along because they have to go work in offices where they have to speak English or Spanish and so on and so forth. There's a logical argument there. If they could remain entirely a part of their culture without their language, then perhaps you could make that decision on the basis of logic or on the basis of funds available or something of that kind. The problem is that so far as we can tell, when you take away the language, you take away the culture. You look at all the people who came in the earlier waves of immigration to the United States. They have, in many ways, homogenized out into some sort of Americans. Now, this is not the famous melting pot that you read about all the time. It obviously doesn't work that well. But people whose great-grandparents came here speaking Irish and as Irish culture people are not distinguishable from people whose great-grandparents came as Germans or as Poles. There seems to be an immediate loss of the culture. And if that is so, then you can no longer make these decisions in that way. One of the things that I wrote the book for, and one of the major reasons for writing such a book, is that we need to find a way to make decisions about language policy in this country on the basis of what we know scientifically, not on the basis of budgets or politics. And it doesn't seem that our politicians are aware of the importance of that.
In the book, you note that the U.S. and the states, with the possible exception of Hawaii, don't have a coherent official language policy. And you say this is unfortunate, but, you know, I wonder about that a little bit. I'm not so sure. I haven't thought about it.
Well, you know, there's a difference between a language policy and having language police. You know, I didn't mean by that we ought to have a language academy and laws that lay down exactly how language should be. What I meant was we don't even have a body of guiding principles for deciding whether in a given school district certain languages should or should not be taught and when they should or should not be taught. Those decisions are always made, by and large, on the basis of money and on the basis of a sort of public opinion about which is more important, football or French, you know, or football or Cambodian. And there isn't a foundation in our educational system for making these decisions. So it isn't the case in the United States that you begin studying linguistics on a sort of baby basis the way you start botany by looking at autumn leaves. You know, we don't have anything like that, so that people would come out of an ordinary high school education well conversant with the basic issues of linguistics and able to go on and apply that if they become politicians and officials and administrators. We don't have that. We have a huge ignorance about language. So when it comes down to deciding, shall we hire another teacher to teach a foreign language, or shall we hire another teacher to teach another sport? There isn't a scientific basis for the people involved to use in making that decision. That worries me.
Yeah.
All of the language policies in the sense of Newspeak, at which you began this discussion with, or in the sense of language academies and institutes, they have never worked. In very, very small countries, you can get a certain amount of conformity by legislation. Norway is a good example of that. But you try to extend it at all, and you discover it simply isn't possible to legislate language. It doesn't work. In France, where they have this very prestigious language academy, the result of the language academy is that the written language and the spoken language have grown so far apart, it's difficult to tell that the two are the same thing. And it's getting worse all the time. And so we know you can't just have language laws. They just don't work. But a language policy would be a body of guiding principles based on science and the real world and not on political issues and emotion and money.
Yeah. Boy, we've just hardly, I can't even say we've scratched the surface here today. So
it's a big, there's a lot underneath.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a wonderful, it's just wonderful to stop and think about it, because language is such a, it's a wonderful thing. I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon, and maybe we'll talk again.
It's been a great pleasure. I'd love to do it again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Suzette Hayden Elgin has been our guest this afternoon. She's a specialist in applied psycholinguistics. She's the founder and director of the Ozark Center for Language Studies. She's the author of numerous books and audio programs on language, including The Language Imperative, The Power of Language to Enrich Your Life and Expand Your Mind. The book is published by Perseus.